Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, we begin today following up on some troubling environmental news from West Louisville. The Environmental Protection Agency announced the results of soil testing from residential properties bordering the old Blackleaf Chemical site in the Park Hill neighborhood. The various levels of toxic substances were found in all of the samples, 50 in all. Here to talk about it all, what happens next, are Louisville Metro Councilman David James. His 6th Council District includes the Blackleaf site. Councilman, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And also with us, WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson, who's been covering the story. First of all, a little background, and we'll start with you, Erica. Exactly what is Blackleaf? What do they make there?
Well, Blackleaf is it's a 29-acre site in the Park Hill neighborhood, and it's been occupied by various companies over the past 60 years or so. They stopped manufacturing in about 1970, but basically it manufactured pesticides, DDT, dieldrin, things that today we know are dangerous, but back then they didn't.
So what exactly did the EPA find in its testing?
Well, what they did was they tested 50 yards, and these are all homes that pretty much abut the Blackleaf site. They had found contamination on the Blackleaf site, and they wanted to see if that had spread to individual properties. They tested 50 yards, and in every single one of them, they found something. And that kind of ranges. They were looking for heavy metals. In some yards, they found signs of lead or arsenic. They were also looking for pesticides. They found that in some yards as well. Yeah. And in some yards, they also found something called benzoapyrene, which is a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon, or a PAH, which is a probable human carcinogen. So it kind of, depending on what yard you're in, it was something a little bit different everywhere.
So there's varying degrees of risk, I guess, depending on the exact place.
Yeah, there are. And that's something that the EPA has been careful to say. They just because you have this in your yard does not mean, there's an imminent health risk. It doesn't mean there isn't. They aren't saying that yet either. But it doesn't necessarily mean, they don't want people to freak out about this yet. They did find higher levels in 9 of the yards. And they sent this highly technical letter to homeowners, basically informing them of that. And these 9 yards, there are higher levels. And so those will assumedly kind of be, first up for remediation, but we have a clip here from the EPA on scene coordinator Art Smith, who is the one here in Louisville who's been managing that.
Just because it exceeded a removal management level, it didn't imply that the adverse health effects will occur again. It just indicates that those homes are likely to go on a list for future cleanup, and if so, would be the focus of a cleanup earlier than other homes that did not exceed risk management levels.
And so, they're being careful to kind of cage their language here. And right now, all they're really telling people is that they recommend washing their hands if they're outside and in the dirt.
And Councilman James, you, of course, you've been in contact with the EPA and, of course, your constituents out there. First of all, what is the EPA saying about how it's addressing the contamination?
The EPA is still studying the situation to get a little bit more information and to coordinate with its partners to determine their course of action for the upcoming future. We've also discussed ways to better inform the community about what's going on. As Erica said before, the letter that is sent to the residents is a pretty highly technical document and doesn't really answer a lot of questions. And so Art Smith and I met, and he recognizes that and understands that and wants to be open and transparent in this process so that people understand that, and I want them to be also. And so we're working on trying to arrange a meeting, a public meeting, probably within the next 30 days at Wheatley Elementary School, and there'll be more information about that coming out soon.
But who would be responsible for cleaning this up, or is that still being determined?
That's still being determined. The EPA attorneys are meeting with the attorneys for the respective businesses that have been there to try and find some resolution that is agreeable to everybody. And so how that will eventually look, I'm not sure. And so we'll wait and see on that one.
And I think when I first started reporting about this, I think it was back in January or February, one of the most kind of the most extreme way of remediation they were talking about was actually physically excavating the soil from the yards that were contaminated and replacing it all with fresh soil, you know, reseeding it, putting it back like it was, but actually getting the soil out of there, which, you know, I'd imagine is a pretty large endeavor, you know, and expensive. Mm-hmm.
What is on the site now? Is it just an abandoned property?
It's abandoned property, some abandoned warehouses and buildings rest on the property now.
And one of the problems originally was there's a fence surrounding the property, and in some places it was damaged. It was actually caved in a couple of places, and there were signs of trespassing, which, you know, became a concern when they discovered that the area was highly contaminated. They didn't want people going in and being exposed to that, as well as, you know, possibly taking it out with them. But so they fixed the fence, I believe, since
yes.
then.
And Councilman, of course, you've been speaking with the constituents there. How worried are they?
The letter is not user-friendly, and the EPA admits that, and that's why they want to have the conversation. And so it caused some concern and alarm in some folks that live around the area. And so there are some that are very concerned. They have children that live there, and they want to make sure they protect their families and that they're protected, and they want to know what to do. And so they have a lot of questions, and hopefully we will have some answers for them very shortly.
What have your interactions been like with the EPA? How are they to work with?
They're very open and very much wanting to do what the right thing is. And because they are required to send that letter out within a certain time period when they discover that there's a problem, that's a requirement by law. So is that letter, the way it's written, is a requirement by law. So therefore, they recognize that that is not the most warm and friendly letter that you could receive. And so the EPA is good to work with. They're wanting to help. They're wanting to talk to people. They want people that have questions to call them, and they're going to be helping us and myself go door to door to talk to people in the affected area. So they're good to work with.
Go ahead.
One thing I think too is important to note. Councilman James and I were talking about this earlier, that they tested 50 homes and they found contamination in all of them, but they originally, in order to do soil testing on private property, the EPA sent letters to, I believe, about 80 homeowners. They had to get, you know, permission to do it, and they only got permission from 50, and that's who they tested. So not only is there a possibility that there are more homes contaminated among this initial group, there's really no way to know right now how far the contamination spreads, whether it's really limited to the homes that are right next to the site or whether it could go farther in either direction.
That's right. We had that discussion and we talked about, you know, what's the borderline? You know, if Erica lives next door to me and they tested her home, mm-hmm. but they didn't test my home, how do I know that my home is safe? And so we've had some discussions around that and about possibly expanding the testing area.
So there could be a wider radius of contamination, but still need to be tested. Has there anything similar been going on at other sites? Either one of you can answer this question around Louisville, and how has it been addressed?
Not since I've been here. I've only been in Louisville about a year. I mean, I know there are other sites of concern. I mean, the Lee's Lane landfill, you know, former Superfund site kind of comes to mind. But those are all older sites that I don't think there's still, you know, active testing going on, at least in homes around it.
Right. As I always tell people, I'm a baby councilman. So I've been here about a year and a half, maybe. And this is the first EPA issue I've had to deal with in my district. And I just adopted this part of the district when they did redistricting. So it's the only one that I know of.
Well,
and Councilman James, is there, it seems like a huge piece of land to me, you know, 29 acres in the middle of this, you know, pretty high density urban area.
Yes.
Is there any chance that this can eventually be remediated and actually be, you know, something good for the district rather than a toxic site?
I'm hoping that it'll be something good for the district. What helped spur some of this was somebody was looking to possibly put some residential housing there, which caused the EPA to start doing the testing. And so part of my questioning to the EPA was, you know, can we put a big cap on this? Do we have to dig it all up? And what are those answers? And they're still working to find those answers for me.
I mean, I think even a park or something that at least would be, you know, positive and not
yes.
surrounded by a fence would be great.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
Let's talk about, again, some of the specific substances that were found. When you refer to heavy metals, exactly what are those?
Well, those are things like lead and arsenic. I mean, those are things that, you know, quite honestly, we're exposed to in much higher quantities now than you know, human beings have been in the past. In high levels, they can cause problems. I mean, everyone knows, you know, you don't eat arsenic. I mean, it's right. It's a poison. Lead poisoning is, you know, is thankfully, now that there's not lead being used in paint commonly, it's becoming less common, but it can have a really serious effect on the central nervous system, and especially in children. If, you know, if you rent or buy a house that has lead paint, you're required to be informed of that and sign a disclaimer, because if your kid is exposed to it, is eating paint chips off the porch or something, it can really cause some serious delays that are really kind of impossible to. I mean, there are ways to treat it, but it's really hard to get over. So that's one of the concerns, especially for you know, kids who might be, you know, out eating dirt. I mean, kids put everything in their mouth.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So that's some of the concerns with the heavy metals. With the other stuff, I mean, you know, pesticides like dialdrin, you know, have been proven to be dangerous, and benzoapyrene, which I know sounds, you know, like technical but it's I mean, it's a PAH, which we're finding out more and more about. And it's been listed by the EPA as a probable human carcinogen. They don't have enough evidence right now to say it's definite, but it's been shown to cause some problems in the past. So these are kind of the red flags that are that are up here and that are raising eyebrows, I think.
And Councilman, I'm sure you'll be in touch with your constituents as these meetings are scheduled.
Absolutely. There'll be announcements coming out. We'll be going door to door and handing out leaflets to announce that the meetings are coming up. And we're also going to try to go to those other houses that didn't return a letter to the EPA to try to get permission to test those properties also.
All right. Thanks to Councilman David James and WFPL Environment reporter Erica Peterson as we continue to cover the discovery of a contamination at the old Blackleaf site in Louisville's Park Hill neighborhood. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, yesterday, Mayor Greg Fisher unveiled his proposed city budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. The mayor had warned that it would be an austere spending plan, as Metro government has been facing a multi-million dollar shortfall. Here to talk about it is WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Philip, welcome back.
Hey, Rick.
Well, I guess a lot of this depends on where you sit, but the budget appears to be austere, but not quite draconian.
Not totally. I mean, as the mayor said, it's not all gloom and doom. And I think for many observers, residents, and council members, there's a sign, at least, that maybe we're starting to turn on the corner here as far as getting the cities beginning to crawl into recovery. Still seeing some of these large deficits, about a $20 million shortfall for next year's budget. But the mayor said he balanced that with a number of different measures and was able to make some highlights of his own as far as certain spending where he wants to make certain investments. For example, you're seeing $500,000 being put into buying land for West Louisville development, economic development out there. The city's putting in $100,000. It's also being matched by $900,000 in the private sector to create this $1 million summer jobs program. The mayor said, as we see the federal government pulling funding out of sectors like that, it's important for the city to invest in that area. Also, I think one of the things that got the biggest applause line was the Southwest Regional Library, which the city will pay $9.5 million, and the Library Foundation will raise $3.5 million to get that project under construction. That $9.5 million is the only bond that the mayor took out, so that's the only money that he's borrowing. Also of interest is the $500,000 that's going to be used to help development down on 4th Street Live, and we have a clip here where the mayor talks about how important it is to invest into downtown Louisville.
We know that we need a thriving retail section of downtown to support residential life, downtown workers, and out-of-town guests. In fact, the top question that's asked by downtown visitors is, where can I shop? South 4th Street, the historic shopping center of our city, is the most likely place for downtown retail to take off, and it's beginning to get some lift. We'll be investing $500,000 there, paying for better lighting, an important safety issue, as well as sidewalk and other improvements. Growth there is going to have the added benefit of generating new downtown tax dollars that will be added to the arena TIF.
So you see, you know, the mayor is not just making cuts and laying folks out there. Actually, no layoffs, no furloughs. Actually, non-union employees will get a 2% raise increase. So you're seeing here another example of the mayor trying to make some of those investments. Now, this budget is not without controversy. There is this issue that came up during the press briefing where Chief Financial Officer Steve Rowland says that Park is going to pay the city $3.9 million for two garages, which Park purchased from the former county government. But at the time of merger, that transaction is not on the receivables, in layman terms, that means that Park never paid post-merger for those lots that was owned by the former county government. So mm-hmm. This has raised some questions from some council members, particularly Council President Jim King, wondering, number one, how is it that those garages were sold during merger and the city's never received any payment until just now? And also the question of, will there be a reappraisal for those buildings to where we should charge perhaps interest to get the taxpayers the money back? Because $3.9 million back in 2003 mm-hmm. is probably more than that now in 2012.
As you may have mentioned, no layoffs or furloughs in the budget. But who's going to be complaining the most? Who are we going to be hearing from?
I think you're going to hear arts groups and a number of social services organizations complain. Let's remember that when people say that, you know, the mayor can say, well, I didn't cut the budget. Well, technically, we all know when he proposes a budget, the Metro Council revises it. They can add money. They usually do to certain external agencies. And the mayor's proposal is short of what it was last year, which the council passed. So many arts groups and social service organizations are complaining about the lack of funding. I think you will hear some complaints from University of Louisville Hospital as far as the Indigent Care Fund. The city is only putting in $7 million this time. Usually they put in about 9.6 and usually get that rebate back from University Hospital, but this year it's just going to be $7 million up front. So there will be some issues there, and council members are saying, hey, listen, we're just now getting the budget just like the rest of you all are, so we're going to have a month to go over this and pull some things in and out, whether it's Louisville Metro Animal Services, whether it's public safety. We have many questions we want to ask over the next month, so we could see this budget go anywhere. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I think the good news is that, like you said, no layoffs, no furloughs, and no tax increases.
So what happens now? There are going to be hearings?
Yes, the budget hearings will begin next week. I believe it starts with public safety, but over the next month, you'll have different department heads come in and explain what they plan to do with these funds, or how they plan to meet these requirements or go try to make budget. Also, the projections as far as growth, which is, I think, expected to be about 2.4%, so moderate marginal growth at best. And then you'll also have time for members of the public to come in and share their views and see how they want the budget to go. And then, of course, council members will draft one and craft one that we will hopefully will see pass before July 1st.
And again, the mayor has cautioned that the next budget could be equally austere.
Yeah, because in this budget address, the mayor spent most of his time talking about the structural imbalance. And he said he's addressed that a little bit as far as dealing with the overtime cost. People may remember the audit showing that overtime costs were exponential. He sort of brought some reforms to that system in the sense that you can't get overtime unless you work at least 40 hours a week as a Metro mm-hmm. employee. Some council members, particularly on the Republican side, are saying, and Councilman Jerry Miller, I think, is leading this chorus, saying that, you know, we need to be a bit more aggressive with this. It's a good start to deal with overtime as far as that $3 million in reduction, but there are some other structural imbalances out there as far as employee benefits and health care costs and things of that nature that we need to deal with as a city. So, you know, in the future, I think Fisher's legacy will be in these budgets. How will he deal with that structural imbalance? How will he be able to put that at ease so we don't have, whether the economy is good or bad, the city's budget starting off at a deficit?
All right. And again, Metro Council budget hearings are upcoming. Philip, thanks for enlightening us on the city budget, and we're going to keep an eye on the proceedings as they go on. We're going to switch gears now and talk about the election, the primary election from Tuesday night, and the stage is now set for the November general election here in Kentucky and elsewhere. First of all, we'll go back to you, Philip, and joining us is Gabe Buller, WFPL News Director, and Kenny Colston, the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio, which includes WFPL. Welcome in, guys.
Hey. Thanks.
But I want to go back to you, Philip. A big night for the Tea Party the other night.
Yeah, I mean, not only did we see the Tea Party, I think, grab another congressional seat with Thomas Massie winning the Republican race for the 4th District, and likely will go on to win the general election in that heavily Republican district. But we saw here even at the Metro Council a Tea Party candidate, Marilyn Parker, beat incumbent John Ackerson, Republican, in the 18th District by 37 votes. And this was a nail biter really to the end, Rick. And people might remember the majority of council members on the Metro Council backed Parker over Ackerson, and we're using pretty harsh language, saying things like that Ackerson wasn't trustworthy, going as far as to say that he sort of made backroom deals with Democrats to shut down debates on key issues. So they not only supported him verbally and politically, but also financially. So many council members backed Parker's campaign over Ackerson, and we saw her pull it out really by 37 votes. Now, the question for Parker, I think, is that even though District 18 is a heavily Republican district, she's likely to win that one. She's a bit controversial. Not only has she spoken out against the Jefferson County Public School student assignment plan, and she's a member of the Tea Party, but she's also flirted with the birther movement. For those who are not familiar with that movement, the movement that questions whether President Obama is actually a U.S. citizen. I talked to Ms. Parker about those views last week, and she sort of had stood on both sides of the fence.
Did you ever at one point contest President Obama's citizenship as far as his birth certificate was concerned?
I think it's something that every voter should look at because there's so much out there about it. You know, it's a dead issue. Not many people are talking about it right now. The election's, you know, coming up, and it probably won't make any difference. I think there is something going on out in Arizona right now where a guy in leadership is requesting proof of that, and they might not put him on the ballot in Arizona. But you know, it's an issue that was out there. But you know, Hillary Clinton was the one that brought it up in the first place, and that's what gave it airtime.
Do you think that President Obama is a U.S. citizen?
Judging from right now, I think that. You know, I'm not going to answer that because it doesn't have anything to do with this Metro Council race. It'll just be sensationalized in the media, and okay, you know, so I'm not going to answer it.
Before each council meeting, members of the council take the Pledge of Allegiance, and you take the Pledge of Allegiance, I'm assuming, as well.
Uh-huh.
President Obama is considered the Commander-in-Chief, so if someone doesn't believe that he is a rightful U.S. citizen, I mean, that would be a pretty serious matter. If the Commander-in-Chief is not an actual U.S. citizen.
You're right. Absolutely, it would. That's why there's so much controversy over it.
So I guess point blank, I mean, do you think he's a U.S. citizen?
You know what? Given the information, I mean, he put out a birth certificate, so I would have to say at this point, right now, I would say yes. From the information that we have at this point, I would say yes, I think he is a U.S. citizen.
So... okay, this birther issue, I mean, yes, literally. I mean, because the fact that this is even an issue, I think, is problematic in a number of ways for many members of the Metro Council, including Councilwoman Tina Ward-Pugh, who has said in the past, you know, she welcomes women on the Metro Council, but she's a bit worried about issues like this coming out from Ms. Parker. I talked to Councilman Ken Fleming, who's the chair of the Republican caucus. He says, you know, this is a federal issue. When she ran for Congress, Parker addressed this, but she's not addressing this as a Metro Council. But then I asked him, was President Obama a U.S. citizen? And he gave the answer, well, I don't have enough documentation to comment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that someone would have to produce a birth certificate, I don't know how many times, Rick, you were asked to produce your birth certificate to prove you're a citizen. But the fact that this is a sort of even a political talking point on the right, I think, raises some questions for people about Parker's candidacy. It's unlikely that it'll deter her at all. She has been very focused on this race and has been a very great challenger and the second person who's to unseat an incumbent on the Metro Council's history. So, but still, the mere fact that this is even an issue that someone can't answer straightforward, yes, he's a U.S. citizen, he's the president of the United States, I think it worries a few political observers, to say the least.
Does she have any views on issues that would affect the council district she'd be representing?
Well, she has. Thank you. She has come out and said she wants to cut discretionary spending. She said that, you know, that's a part of fiscal responsibility. I believe it said that she wants to cut it by at least 50%. So there are some council issues. She certainly wants to tighten ethics reform. Even though these controversial issues seem to be more and more talked about more and more, she's certainly someone who I think many expect will have a conservative voice on the council on issues involving city government.
We'll come back to the council in just a moment. Kenny, I want to turn to you because Philip mentioned the 4th District congressional race in the hand of Rand Paul, very evident in this win by Massey.
Yeah, Senator Rand Paul made basically his first Kentucky endorsement. He's gone out of state for a lot of U.S. Senate endorsements. This is the first time he got involved in a Kentucky race in that 4th congressional district, and he endorsed Thomas Massey, who was kind of the Tea Party guy in that race. And Massey had a very not surprising victory, but I would say the margin on Tuesday night was very surprising. I mean, outpacing his nearest opponent by 20-something points. It was never close. Massey had a lot of advantages. Obviously, Rand Paul's endorsement helped coalesce Tea Party behind Massey. Also had a lot of outside super PAC help, almost half a million, that'd be insane, but half a million dollars in ads. That was almost saturation. I mean, you couldn't turn on the TV or watch a news program without seeing an attack ad against the other two front runners, Gary Moore or Alicia Webb Edgington. But a very strong performance by Thomas Massey. It gives Rand Paul some more weight here in the state that, you know, his endorsement does carry. And although I will say this, I'm not sure this will open the door to the floodgates of the Rand Paul endorsements. I think considering his election, an endorsement from Senator McConnell played so much into his election to the U.S. Senate, he'll probably be selective like McConnell, but it definitely gives him some weight.
I want to turn to the presidential race. Gabe, you reported this week that the uncommitted won 42% of Kentucky's Democratic primary vote, and of course one of the other candidates is Barack Obama.
Yeah, the only other candidate. I think a lot of people were surprised watching the election returns on Tuesday night to see that the President of the United States garnered just 58% of supporters from his own party, pretty much of registered Democrats who went out to vote in Kentucky. And it's surprising to see, but we were doing some analysis of this and looking at these numbers, and there's a lot of debate going on locally and nationally about what all this means. But a phrase that Kenny used and that I just shamelessly stole is that these voters who voted uncommitted, it's about 87,000 people, are a fraction of a fraction. They're the fraction of people who actually came out to vote. Turnout overall for both parties was just under 14%, which is very, very low. And since it's closed primaries in Kentucky, anyone who's a registered Democrat is going to go out and they have to vote a Democratic ballot. But a lot of people who are registered Democrats in Kentucky are registered to vote on the city level, on the levels where there's a little bit more action on the Democratic side. And for national issues, they will likely almost always favor a Republican candidate. These are people who are likely going to vote for Mitt Romney, who may have supported Rick Santorum or Ron Paul even, who also garnered a bit of the Republican primary vote. So it does seem like it's surprising. And then if you look at these numbers of who voted for whom, it starts to become even more clear. The president did not get a lot of votes outside of cities. He didn't get votes in rural areas in general. There's one county where he tied, I think, at 479 votes with uncommitted. But mostly, you look at the map, and it's blue in the middle for where people voted for the president, and green on the Secretary of State's website, at least in the east and west parts of the state. It's also a big coal area, and you know, the campaign from the coal industry against the president is also pretty severe, and we've seen a lot of that.
I also don't think we can discount, I mean, the elephant in the room, which is race.
I mean,
at the end of the day, people will remember back in 2008, in the Democratic primary between President Obama and Hillary Clinton, that I believe an exit poll showed that 20% of Democratic voters in Kentucky said that race was a leading factor in their decision-making in that election. We're talking about rural Kentucky here, a place where there are very few, if any, African-American faces. Some of the reports that were done by the BBC, Think Progress, and others back in 2008, I think, showed a very ugly side of the Democratic Party that the Democratic leaders do not want to talk about. You also have to remember the fact that the leader of the Democratic Party here in the state, Steve Beshear, the governor, did everything possible to run away from President Obama during his gubernatorial race. You've had many Democrats come out and denounce President Obama here in the state. So, you know, the idea that, as someone observed on Twitter, you know, the idea that the national political party, the National Democratic Party, has anything to do, much connection with rural Democrats in this state, I think is clearly a continuation we see here in the state between the bad relationship between President Obama and state Democrats that just only continues and is exacerbated more and more. I can't think of a time where a sitting U.S. president, his own party, did so much to reject him or distance himself from him, and not only their leadership but in their voters.
Right. In some ways, they are following the example of elected of some elected Democrats in Kentucky. And in bringing up the race issue, that is an issue that some people have been quick to dismiss, pointing out some of those other things, turnout numbers and all that, coal country even. But the fact is that there were a lot of issues uncovered in 2008 by various reports, Think Progress and the BBC. And it would be hard to think that all those issues vanished
in
4 years.
And let's also recall, Kentucky has never elected an African-American statewide.
Mm-hmm. No, that's correct. Before we say goodbye to you folks, Philip, I want to circle back to the Metro Council very quickly. Attica Scott, the winner in the 1st District, and Barbara Shanklin in the 2nd District on the Metro Council, two races that have been...
Let's start with District 2. I mean, many people think the fact that, you know, Councilwoman Shanklin, always very popular in her district, despite the fact that she had this controversy involving her grandson, she was running against really two low-name candidates who really split the vote. Councilwoman Shanklin only got 48%. In District 1, I think many were surprised of how much flex that Councilwoman Scott showed against her opponents. I think Stephen Colston did very well in the Southwest, better than expected for many. Ray Barker only got about 24%. Of note, though, should be that 2 years ago, former Councilwoman Judy Green got 2,000 votes in that primary. She almost got more votes in that race than total voted for in this race. So if she had brought those votes with her, she would still win. So I think many people are wondering, could Councilwoman Green in 2 years run for this seat again and win it? Clearly the votes show that she could.
All right. Philip M. Bailey, Gabe Bullard, Kenny Colston, thanks for joining us as we set the stage for the November general election in Kentucky.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Byline on WFPL. Courier Journal publisher Wesley Jackson is in an odd position. He's essentially the connection between a local institution, the paper, and a giant national corporation, CJ parent company Gannett. During a dramatic shift, with revenue waning and orders from Gannett, the Courier will soon start charging visitors to its website who read more than a certain number of articles each month. The paper will also make changes in its content to focus on watchdog journalism and lifestyle stories. WFPL's Gabe Bullard talked with Jackson about the changes coming to the Courier Journal.
This is a time of a pretty great change at the newspaper. And I was wondering how you see your role at the Courier. Do you see yourself as restoring an institution to a place in the community it once had, or do you see yourself as transitioning into a new era for the Courier Journal?
Well, I think we are keeping parts of, I think, what has made this organization great. We need to transform this organization as well as we start to really consider the number of different ways people are receiving their news and information, and certainly the challenges facing our advertisers as well, and finding new ways to reach people both digitally and using our printed products. I do see my role as respecting the tremendous history of this organization and its core mission to serve this community, and doing that in all of the new ways that people are receiving their information, and including the newspaper itself, the printed edition.
One big change that's coming up soon, and I think the change that most people are talking about, is the addition of a paywall.
You know, the paywall itself is for subscribers. They should, once they activate their account, they'll never notice any meaningful difference in terms of how they access the content. What they'll see is more content on our website. If you're not a subscriber, there'll be a certain number of articles you can view at no charge every 30-day period of time, and will allow them, in essence, to sample our content. What it won't be, though, is, for instance, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, allows you to see the first paragraph, for instance, of an article if you're not a subscriber.
Mm-hmm.
You will actually be able to see the entire article, and if it's a video that we have on our website, the entire video and all the surrounding information, and that will count as one article experience. So people will still be able to experience some of our content, but to have full access to all of it, you'll need to be a subscriber.
What's the limit for articles that someone can look at before they have to become a subscriber each month?
Right now, that number will change over time, so we're still working on setting that exact amount, but it will be between 10 and probably 20 articles each month.
And how well do you think the paywall will work in terms of providing the needed revenue that it should?
We believe it's going to be effective. I think a couple of things that are a part of this is we look at our overall subscription model. One of the things that we have to do is take into account certainly our investments that we're trying to make in content after, you know, we've been in a process of reducing our overall journalistic staff, everything else. And what we're trying to do is stem that tide, number one, and make sure that we keep enough scale in the market to continue to cover the issues that are relevant. And with that, we still have, even after the early retirement program that I think, you know, was pretty well publicly acknowledged and some of the layoffs that we've had, we still have more journalists covering local news and information than any other organization in the state of Kentucky. And as we start looking at those, plus increasing delivery cost of the printed version, newsprint and ink, we have to increase our prices of the printed product, and as well as begin to charge for access to our digital product as well. So that combination, we think what will happen is most of our subscribers, a large portion, will access us in print as well as digitally. And some of that will bring new people to our digital assets, whether that's the website proper or through our iPhone or iPad application.
You mentioned that there have been layoffs and there have been early retirement offers. And while the Courier does have the most reporters of any news outlet in the state, it's fewer reporters than there used to be. And the digital product has been free for so long. How do you think people will adapt to paying for the first of all, just paying in general, and they're getting less reporting than they got, say, a year ago for free?
Well, I think part of that is, first, on the website, if you look at the amount of content that we can edit, evaluate, and then originate with our reporters, there's a significant amount of content on the website and through our digital offerings that we just can't put in the paper, just from the raw volume of that. So I think the overall content that people have access to in some ways has grown significantly via the website. I also say that, you know, the hard fact for us is that we have to begin to reorganize our business, which we have begun before I got here. And with that reorganization, as we start looking at how we transform and use digital to share more information than we can in print, take advantage of that, of those opportunities for our subscribers, and focus our resources that we have into stories, information, and content that is local, relevant, and high impact. And the combination of those two items, I think, can still bring a very compelling product to the marketplace for the price we charge for it.
As Courier Journal publisher Wesley Jackson, he spoke with WFPL's Gabe Bullard. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this is the segment we typically set aside for the arts and weekend arts events, and today is no exception. And here is WFPL's Aaron Keene with two special guests. Aaron?
Thanks a lot, Rick. I'm here with authors Al DiGenova and Pam Steele. They're both alumni of the Spalding University Master of Fine Arts and Writing program, which is having its semi-annual residency this weekend. And they're here to read from their new books, and so they're on today to share a little bit about their writing process and a little from their new works. So, Al, your new book is Postcards to Jack, and it's poems from the road?
Right. It's traveling and place is really what it's all about, a collection of Haibun and poetry.
Wow. So Jack is Jack Kerouac, I presume.
It is Jack Kerouac. So he's addressed directly in a number of the poems.
Is he? Would you like to read one for us?
Sure. This one is called Lonesome Traveler, and it does address Kerouac. Lonesome Traveler. Kerouac, you have a way with sad. Sad cracked hands of all-night diners, sad gravel under shapeless shoes, sad waning moon of November roads, sentimental sadness, familiar sadness, old friend, sad Jack, tell me if sad tastes like black dust to you. If it smells like burning leaves, tell me it is more than easy metaphor, 'cause I can taste it on my breakfast toast. Such a small word for a poet, so much smaller than love, the distillate of love, grand love that inspires yet lives and dies in three breaths. Sad as old as coal and deep in veins, reaching to our core, old friend, the sad eternal core. Drink that last shot down, buddy. It's a long, cold walk to the diner.
Oh, thank you.
Nice.
Nice.
Thank you.
And, you know, On the Road is is, you know, there's that sadness in there that you invoke, but it's also kind of a, you know, it's written at a time where there was all this hope that you could, you know, go west, young man, and really like discover America and discover your life. Well, what about your road poems, and what about writing them in the 21st century?
Well, you know, I'm obviously influenced by the Beats and Kerouac, and so, you know, the poems are addressed to him, but it's really, you know, this is about places, and there's a lot of contemporary themes in here, but it picks up on you know, some of the aesthetic, but it's really more of a, it's kind of a journey from one place back home. When you work through the book, it really starts in that sad point and ends up in a happy point. So,
well, so when yeah, your style, I can really hear that Beat influence just in the tempo and in the rhythm of your words, but there. So what is there a tension there inherent in sort of invoking the spirit of the Beats but writing from a, you know, sort of the difference between the atomic age and the Wi-Fi age, one cloud for the other?
Yeah, which is, you know, the Wi-Fi age is addressed in the opening of the book too. It's, you know, it's an influence, and because I'm a jazz musician as well, it just kind of, that rhythm is in the way I write. And I don't really think about it as a direct you know, influence the way the Beats wrote. It's just there, you know, and I can't get away from it.
You play saxophone, right?
Right.
And so were you a saxophone player first and a writer second, or vice versa?
Well, I started playing saxophone first, but I think they both developed kind of side by side, you know, especially through high school.
And you, I've seen some of your performances before where you kind of work the music into...
Yeah, it's still doing that.
Still doing that, yeah. Does that, how does that sort of fit in with the contemporary spoken word scene? Is jazz still as prevalent of an influence on poetry as it once was?
Well, I think now it's more, hip-hop is more the influence, but there's, you know, of course, it's still the rhythm of blues and jazz that's, you know, part of the hip-hop scene. So it's still there, even though slam doesn't allow music, you know, in a slam, it's still part of the performance for a lot of people.
They don't.
No.
I guess I never thought about that, but you don't. Pam, you've kind of seen a lot of slams too and know a lot about that scene, yeah?
Right, and I didn't know they didn't allow music,
no,
but it
no.
just seems musical anyway, so because that's why we didn't notice.
Yeah.
It's all a cappella, right? Well, speaking of place and the lure of place, Pam Steele is here with her new novel, Greasewood Creek. It's a love story between a woman named Avery and her boyfriend Davis, but it's also a novel of loss and mourning as well. Pam, what are you going to read for us today? Can you set that up a little bit?
I'm going to read just a short piece. It's titled Meridian. I live near the 45th parallel, and so it travels from that place back to Appalachia and back again. And what you probably need to know about this before I read it is, again, Avery is the main character. Madeline is her mother, and they're on a trip to take Madeline to a nursing home. They cross the 45th parallel, drive east toward a line of clouds that drag gray tentacles across dry land. Avery cannot smell the rain yet, how it sifts through sagebrush and jack pine, reaches into the sand and dirt of the far hills, gathers a stone-hard scent, lifts it into the wind. Rain, Madeline says. About time. We used to run from it, Madeline says. Could smell it coming, a different kind of smell than here. And we'd run up the holler to the house and put on our swimsuits. Then we'd run down the holler, meet it. Lord God, it was cold. Felt like ice hitting our skin. And if you had a sunburn, worse. She stops talking, looks out the window. Past Baker City, the rain stops. Hills, long curves. Then the land opens up north and east, stretches ahead into Idaho. The flat places remind Avery of home, of fields that say, something happened here. Places where only a moment ago there was noise and commotion, now empty, still.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
And so you live in Eastern Oregon now, but you have roots in West Virginia and Kentucky. And the book goes back and forth between Appalachia and Eastern Oregon. Can you tell us a little bit about how place and landscape functioned in the writing of this book?
Actually, I was telling Al earlier that this started out as a poem, and the first two lines in the book were from a poem that I've been trying to write for a long time. And when I write poetry, I usually start with an image and then jump off from there, and then the story comes. And so that's how I did it.
Can you give us that image? Can we hear this opening line real quick?
The air still holds the shape of the house. August light pushes through cottonwood limbs, no more than air themselves, shimmers off ghost windows.
Wow. And so Pam's first book was a collection of poems, Paper Bird, too. So you started as a poet and then moved into fiction.
I have gone to the dark side.
How is that? Are you using different parts of your writer brain, or are you just building from an image and it just whatever form it takes?
That's right. I start with the image. Writing fiction for me isn't that much different than writing poetry. And I remember the point in which I discovered that what you write in a poem can be fictionalized and it doesn't have to be true. So it's the same thing, only larger.
So what is it about these two landscapes that that made you want to include them both in the book?
Well, a segment of my family from West Virginia traveled to Oregon in the 1930s and homesteaded there, strangely enough, in a place that looks just like West Virginia. And there are remnants of that family left there. And I think it also comes from a sense of which landscape do I really fit into? I love this landscape that we're in now, but I also love the wheat fields and the dry land of eastern Oregon.
Contrary magazine called your book a novel in moments, which I think is really interesting. And the structure of the book is very short scenes, and it's nonlinear, right? Can you talk a little bit about the structure?
Right. When I first thought about taking a novel workshop, I thought, I can't do this. I'm not used to writing this large. And I had a friend who encouraged me to do it. So I took the workshop under the tutelage of Jane Vandenberg out of San Francisco, and she taught us to write in episodes. And she said, you start with an episode, and then you write another one, and then you write another one. And so what I wound up with at the end were all of these episodes that are literally put on the floor of my study and moved around into something that I thought was a good order. And luckily, it stayed that way.
Al, is that sort of similar to how you put your collection of poems together?
Yeah, it, you know, I mean, Each one was written individually, and it wasn't until I saw them shaping themselves that I started directing the writing toward the collection. You know, where I felt there was holes, and I felt that what Pam was talking about, that I've always been a poet, but writing more and more prose poems. So it's kind of the step away from from lined poetry and into a longer thought process, and it's. I still can't get myself to even the short story point. It's still kind of, it's still daunting, but I just, you know, you go with whatever the words are leading you to or the thoughts are leading you to. And so for me, they keep getting longer. So one of these days, it may get to that novel point.
Okay, so we have two poets and also a fiction writer and also a prose poet here. So do we believe in the prose poem? What is the difference between a prose poem and a lyric, image-laden scene from a novel? Al, Pam, go.
I don't think there's much of a difference. You know, I mean, in a novel, obviously, you have there's it's much larger. And in the prose poem, I mean, there's, you know, as Pam just read, the introduction there is a prose poem. You know, there's many novels that you can take a paragraph out and say that's a prose poem. It's, you know, is it a prose poem? Is it flash fiction? I don't know. To me, I think the only differentiation is that with a prose poem, there's much more a sense of immediacy where it's happening in the moment. And that's the only distinguishing factor that I can make, because there are prose poems that are narrative too, you know, with storyline and dialogue, but I try to do them so they feel more immediate.
We're breaking down the walls of genre right here on Byline right now. It's really exciting. Well, and so Al, tell us a little bit about the, there are a lot of haiku in your book, and the haibun also, which is a Japanese hybrid form.
Right. The haibun is a combination of a prose poem followed by a haiku. They're not supposed to be directly related to haiku. It's supposed to kind of augment the internal emotional side of the prose poem. So I attempted to do that, and, you know, that was, you know, the direction I was trying to go with the haiku. And that form is, for me as a poet, it's a great in-between. It lets me take the haiku, which is just that moment of emotion or, you know, observation, and tie it with the bigger scene of the place.
It's an ancient Japanese form, for those of you listening at home. Also one of, I think, the earliest forms of travel writing, too.
Yes,
so kind of a great natural fit for this book.
It fit right in with the idea of, you know, places and traveling.
Well, welcome back to Louisville, both of you. Al lives in Chicago. Pam is with us all the way from Eastern Oregon. And they'll both be reading today at 4:30 at the Brown Hotel with a whole host of other alumni from the Spalding University MFA program. Books will be for sale. There'll be signings and stuff. So if you are intrigued by what you heard, you know, come on down and hear a little more.
All right. Thanks, Aaron Keene, WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter, and Pam and Al. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for sharing your work with us today. That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, and Aaron Keene. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Thanks to Joe Durso for technical support. For information on topics addressed today and to listen to today's show, visit our website, wfpl.org. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.